I'm Jamie Hurst, and for the MSU Denver Alumni Association, we're excited to bring you Bird Talk, a podcast about our alumni, their careers, and their lives.
You put doctor in front of everything, it just means you're smart.
Yeah.
And you know everything. Omnipotent, right?
Or, yeah, you're a glutton for punishment, and you're fine going to school for 7-10 years and spending a lot of money.
Hey, I know.
I'm the lifelong learner, too. I collect degrees like Beanie Babies, so I'm right there with you. Our guest today is Dr. Andrew Dole, a proud 2-time graduate of MSU Denver, earning a 2006 degree in hospitality and a human nutrition and dietetics degree in 2013. Andrew is a lifelong learner whose career uniquely blends culinary arts, nutrition, and human performance. Andrew's path began at the Art Institute of Colorado, where he earned an associate's degree in culinary arts en route to becoming an executive chef. Andrew stayed in the hospitality lane, enrolling at MSU Denver for the first time to study hospitality, tourism, and events management. Now, it's important to note, Andrew is an endurance athlete, so he quickly became increasingly curious about the connection between food and athletic performance. This curiosity led to his second MSU Denver degree, a bachelor's in human nutrition and dietetics. After that, it's been nothing short of a whirlwind. Andrew became a registered dietitian, then a CCSD, then he earned a master's degree in dietetics and a PhD in human performance from the University of Waikato in New Zealand. While in New Zealand, he served as the dietitian for the world-renowned All Blacks and Black Ferns Sevens rugby teams and worked closely with acclaimed researcher Dr. Stacey Sims. Most recently, Andrew was hired as the performance dietitian for the Arizona Cardinals of the NFL, where he brings his expertise to support athletes at the highest level possible of professional sports. His journey is a powerful example of following your passions, embracing lifelong learning, and forging a career that reflects your own unique interests. Andrew, welcome to Bird Talk.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
All right. Well, I'll tell you, I feel like I need a protein shake after just reading that. That's a lot of things to do in a short amount of time. I mean, we're talking about really 20 years, just a wide gamut of interests. And what I love so much about your story is it seems like all the little pockets of things that have brought you passion over the years, you finally found the job that kind of puts it all together.
Yeah, which is really funny because when I first started down on the campus, I actually went for computer science and I was a huge super gaming computer nerd for the longest time. And my first CSCS class was like binary. And I sat through, I want to say 3 classes. And I said, I'm out of here. And I never went back. And so I just started a whole different path. It was really interesting.
Yeah, I imagine, especially like I think about that too. I'm someone with a wide variety of passions. And the things that I did as hobbies that I was like, yeah, this is the thing I want to do with my life. I realized academically, like, not a fit for me. And so I love to see that it's kind of come full circle for you.
Yeah.
So I did do a little bit of a deep dive into this sports RD and had to learn a lot of it because it's really kind of a newer industry, so to speak. I dove into, I don't know what the website was, but it was something about all the professional and college sports. And it looked like it really wasn't until the mid-2000s, that people started to think like, hey, maybe what we put in our body actually will make a difference with our performance, our athletic performance. I think University of Nebraska was the first one to jump in place, some sort of full-time dietitian in the 90s. But then it was a slow roll until about the mid-2010s, until people really committed and pros were almost on the back end of that 2020. So I'd love to know, like, as you started your kind of your education and got deeper into getting a master's in dietetics and then this human performance PhD, was the career that you have now and this job that you have now, was it on the table at that point? Or have you kind of evolved right alongside the industry?
Yeah, no, this was 100% not even in the picture. So I ended up getting into sports nutrition on accident. I used to be, you can't tell because I'm a really small guy now, but into bodybuilding when I was much younger. And I was a chef and a big guy kind of yoked out and I wanted to create a business. And the guy that was training me was an IFBB pro. And he was like, you know, eat boiled chicken and broccoli. And I'm like, you know what? I don't eat like that. I'm a chef. Let me show you what I eat. And I started preparing meals for him. And then I ended up trading my cooking for his training. And I did a show or two, and it actually kind of turned into a bit of a business because he really thought like, oh, I didn't know I could eat like this. And so there was a place in Colorado Springs called Carmichael Training Systems. And at the time I had lived in Castle Rock. And so I was like, well, you know what? Let me build this into a bigger business. I'll do a training table for Carmichael Training Systems. It's all these elite cyclists. They're always here training and endurance athletes. So I drive down after scheduling an appointment with, I can't remember, a director of performance or something there. And I sit down and the first thing he says to me is, he goes, so what are you, a nutritionist or a dietitian? And I'm like, no, I'm just some big guy who can cook, went to culinary school. Well, the conversation didn't really, really remember the rest of it, but I drove the 45 minutes back home going, I don't know what a dietitian is, but I'm going to be one. Yeah. And I looked it up. And I found out that they were, you know, the professional food professionals, et cetera, et cetera. I'm like, well, that's what I'm going to be. And I enrolled back at Metro because I had already had my first degree in culinary and hospitality. And interestingly enough, they had a program, which was perfect. And that's how I got started into the whole sports dietetics and nutrition piece. It was not something that I had planned to do. I was just going to be a chef and cook food and do that kind of thing.
Have you noticed, now that you've been in this space, are there a lot of people coming to the industry with the expertise that you have in the cooking? Or is there still a whole side of the aisle that is still steaming broccoli and peeling chicken and you're just getting the kind of the fuel in your body? Or are you bringing a cool lens that I can make it taste good too?
Yeah, this might be a little controversial because it's actually one of the bones I have to pick with my own profession and industry. There are some very talented individuals who are chefs who have commercial kitchen experience, who have worked in the industry, who are even CECs and ACF certified. I would say we're a rarity. Mm-hmm. There's very few of us who've actually worked in the industry at a professional level and then transitioned into dietetics to take it to a sports profession. So no, the answer is no. There's really not a lot of individuals who have had the time to have two careers and work professionally and get the street cred in the commercial restaurants and food service and then come out the other side to do what we do.
Ah, that's very cool. You're very unique, and I love to hear that. So second degree, came back, got the dietetics degree. Why was Metro the solution for you for both of those degrees?
Right. Well, all right. So let's go even further back.
Yeah, let's do it.
So I'm much older than most people think, actually. Yeah. So I turned 50 in October.
Congratulations.
Yeah. And I started on that campus back in 1993, right? So it was CCD, CU Denver, and MS, and Metro, actually, Metropolitan State College of Denver at that time.
Yeah.
And it's in the center of the city. Like it was the biggest university outside of like CU Denver, just for the amount of people that could go there because of its proximity in the middle. Like everything was there.
Yeah.
You couldn't help but like if it had a program, you wanted to be there. Okay. It's interesting because if you started at CCD and you went to Metro, everything transferred. So the articulation agreements were perfect. So if you had any experience with that, like you've ever moved from university to university and you know how hard it is to get your credits to go back and forth.
Yeah.
The whole articulation agreement between those three universities was amazing. So picking up at Metro was, it was almost a no-brainer. It was perfect. It was easy to get to. It's very convenient. Credits went over and they had the programs I needed. And I think most importantly, how lucky I was that they had the programs I needed. They had hospitality. What were the chances? They had dietetics. What were the chances? So it worked out. It was just lucky. I can't say anything other than that.
Yeah. No, that's incredible. I love that you position it in a way that being downtown is a real big, it's a big pro, you know? And I think we see that a lot from students, especially now as we're recruiting a little bit outside of the traditional Denver metro area. It is a real plus to get to come and have this really great city living. And you get to experience so much of the heartbeat of Colorado while you're taking classes, which is pretty great. I love that that was a big part of your story. I guess we can start at the beginning. Are you from Colorado originally?
I am a native. I was actually born in Colorado, yes, but I lived in the South, lived in North Carolina for some formative years from about 5 to 10, but then moved back to Colorado. So I'd say most of my life there, yeah.
Perfect. Okay. What I'm most curious to learn about is why the move 7,000 miles away to New Zealand.
Yeah.
What drew you to that at that point in your career? I think it's right after you got your master's and now you're kind of in a space where, okay, maybe I want to become a doctor. Maybe I want to just surf a lot. You know, what was it? What was the precipice there?
Yeah. So there's a little bit of a backstory there. So I had taught at the art institutes for about 8 to 9 years teaching culinary. I loved teaching. It was the greatest thing I didn't know I wanted to do. I never missed a day. Mm-hmm. I was there early. I was actually teaching the whole time that I was getting my dietetics degree and my master's degree. So that whole process, it was like those early mornings teaching at 6:30 in the morning and then having a gap I would take the light rail because I was right there at the design center, would take the light rail to classes, have classes in the middle of the day, go back and teach a 5 to 11 p.m., drive back to Castle Rock and just rinse and repeat for 4 or 5 years. It was a really long road to getting that all done. But the purpose for the master's degree was to continue teaching because you had to. And then there was a lot of jobs at the universities there in Colorado, like CU Denver, CU Colorado Springs, and even Metro, for example, that I wanted to teach nutrition at, that I had the skill set from culinary, but I couldn't get hired because I didn't have a terminal degree. I didn't have a PhD. And I really just sort of got tired of getting turned away for some jobs that I really thought I wanted was teaching in a university. And in order to do that, I needed a PhD. To get 7,000 miles away, at that time, I was fully entrenched in my own private practice. So I had spent probably, well, geez, now almost 10 years or so with a private practice. It was really random in the endurance sport. I had started just a general private practice for dietetics. And I had an office, a brick and mortar office in Castle Rock. And I was seeing patients for all types of things, you know, regular insurance type, weight loss, cardiovascular disease. I had a random lady, I didn't know who she was at the time, ask me for help about her first triathlon. She had never done one. She was going to do an Ironman. I'm like, yeah, sure, whatever. I can figure it out. And I tell you, from that point on, gosh, I don't even know how many years ago that was now. It was just endurance sport 100%. That's all I did. And built a private practice, works for some pros, worked with some world champions in that sport discipline, Ultraman specifically, which was really cool.
Okay.
Yeah. And there you go. So then I needed to get a PhD. I still needed to do it. It was the last thing I hadn't ticked off of my list. And I'm one of those kind of like, if I don't have it yet, I need to do it, looking for the credibility piece. There was nothing. Everyone that I contacted in the United States who had a program that I wanted to do that was researching the type of thing that I was researching were either on sabbatical or weren't taking PhD students.
Yeah.
And I had read Stacy's book. And interestingly, about 85% of my clientele, of my patient base was women, was female. So I continued to read her book and learn more about female athletes specifically. And so, you know, as a man in that space, I needed, you know what? I needed actually some credibility because if they read it in the book and I said otherwise, it was like, well, she said this in the book. You're like, yeah, but that's a right different context. So I was like, well, let me just email her. And I messaged her, hey, are you taking PhD students? And she's like, yep. And I got really excited. It was my last shot.
Right.
Kind of told my wife, like, hey, this is, if I don't get this, then we'll just forget the PhD thing and I'll never talk about it ever again. And she messaged back, yeah, absolutely. Fantastic. I'm in New Zealand. And I'm like, oh, of course you're in New Zealand. And at the time it was like pretty cool. Like we didn't know what we were getting into. Everybody wants to go to New Zealand. I applied. I ended up getting a stipend and a scholarship. So they paid me to go there and do my research for 3 years.
That's pretty incredible.
Really, everything that turned out from that point was somewhat storybook.
Yeah, that sounds just about as storybook as it can possibly get.
Yeah.
Especially from just a quick email that sent like, hey, really looking to want to do something. You're in this space. And are you taking a PhD student? Because that answer could have so easily been no. And then you'd be on the hook to the promise you made your wife that said, all right, I'm done. You know?
Indeed. I would have been done. Who knows where I would have been? Like, yeah, the shot to end up there. And
yeah,
and then right place, right time. The university was at the same training center where the Olympic teams were. There was a guy from North America there who was like, hey, we need a dietitian. We need somebody. Do you want to apply? I'm like, I don't know. I'm doing this PhD thing. I don't have the time. What do I do? At that time, I actually asked my advisor, Stacy, is like, do I do this? She's like, yeah, absolutely. I was like, well, okay, sure. And 3-4 years later, there you go. An Olympic campaign, gold medal, probably Britain the cart before the horse here, but and got my PhD done in record time with, you know, novel research, which was very cool. So yeah, again, storybook.
Oh, that's awesome. So yeah, so you were in Paris for the Olympics with the All Blacks Sevens rugby squad. Did you know anything about rugby before that? I mean, I know the dietetics piece is going to be athletic specific, but did you know much about rugby? Because I think back to, I worked in college athletics for about 10 years. And one of the first programs that I was assigned to from an academic advising standpoint was the women's soccer program at Iowa State. And I obviously grew up around soccer, but I never played it. And then all of a sudden I'm traveling with a soccer team and I'm sitting on the bench and real quickly, you know, you pick up the lingo so fast, yeah. You know, good ball, good this. And all of a sudden I'm like this soccer aficionado. I then got assigned to the gymnastics team. Same thing. Like, you know, you watch the gymnastics every 4 years in the Olympics, but then all of a sudden you're there and you're on the floor and you're watching this and you're seeing, oh, that was a 10th deduction because her handstand didn't get fully the way that it needed to. Oh, she didn't combine those two elements. So there could be a big deduction.
Yeah.
It was such a fascinating thing for me to be like, oh, I actually understand these sports because I'm in the middle of this and watching these girls train on the daily, see what they go through. And so I just often wonder when, especially someone from America, where rugby's growing here, but it hasn't always been a predominant sport, you're now in New Zealand where rugby's the thing. Did you know much about it or did you have to kind of learn as you went?
No, you know, believe it or not, there's actually a very huge rugby presence in Glendale, Colorado, where I live.
Is there?
Colorado has a very large rugby presence. And I played rugby in high school and I played a little bit when I had come out of high school.
It's perfect.
Yep. So I knew we played 15s. Now sevens is different. 15s, it's still the same idea. And we don't play the same way they do, but the sport is the sport. So no, I did have some knowledge of the game. I didn't have an appreciation for what the sevens was.
Yeah.
Or really women's rugby the way I did with the Black Ferns, who were, you know, world champions three times over and gold medalists. So great reintroduction to the sport there.
Yeah. Oh, very, very cool. I've never been to an Olympic Games. How cool was that? Is it really just all the feelings because you're surrounded by just the elite of the elite and all the pomp and circumstance? That had to feel really cool.
Yeah, that's actually interesting. So we went to Soustons, France for a month before the Olympic Games, and we did a camp there. So both teams, the All Black Sevens, the Black Fern Sevens, we went there and trained and were in place and lived at a facility there for the whole time leading up into them leaving to the village. And then that was actually remarkable. It was a remarkable 3 or 4 weeks managing all of the food and the training and all of those things. When they went to the village, I actually took the opportunity to come home because I had not been home in the United States for, at that point, almost 4 years.
Oh, wow.
When I had came to New Zealand in 2021, it was April or March. That was the middle of COVID. Everything, the whole world was on lockdown. They let 150 PhD students into New Zealand, into the country, and I was one of them when we left. Mm-hmm. And so we couldn't leave for the first 2 years because if we left, we would have not been able to come back in because we weren't residents. So really, we were actually kind of prisoners in New Zealand for the first 2.5 years. And then when we realized we actually could leave, it was too crazy to do so with work and everything. Mm-hmm. So I went to France, stayed there for a month with them, and then they went to the village. I went to Paris with them, and then I left and came home, and I actually watched the Olympics from the comfort of my in-laws' house, which is probably good because my heart probably wouldn't have been able to handle it.
Oh, I believe it.
It was amazing to watch just on TV. Yeah.
That's so cool. What a neat experience. I often think about that. So I was a Division II athlete. I played softball in college, and this was late 90s, early 2000s. So, I mean, we barely had a strength coach. It was like twice a week we would go lift with somebody. She was actually an endurance athlete and I think was one of the recreation directors. So we did a lot of running, which now I look back and I was like, oh, it's just she did for us what she knew. But probably as a softball athlete, we didn't need to be running 3-4 miles to stay in shape. Right. So just a different time. Like I said at the beginning, like the last 20 years have really blown up the specificity of training athletes. But I do think about how incredible it is that with the teams, you were able to kind of acclimate to France for 3 months, you know, in advance or however long you were there, right? You're getting your food made for you in a way that's going to be fueling you. You likely have all the best accommodations for resting, for rehab, for training, and just the difference that that makes when you're at that level. And I just think, my gosh, we've taken sports to a whole new place and I appreciate it. And then there's a part of me that's super jealous that's like, I wonder how good of an athlete I could have been if some of those things were available, you know, in the 80s and 90s growing up.
But yeah, you'd be surprised.
Alas, here we are. Instead, I do podcasts.
We do what we love. There are some countries around the world who, like you say, we went and we had the best. We were a very well-resourced program and we went to a very nice place. But there are places in the country, like we play some teams who around the world have nothing.
Yeah.
And they do amazing. Like they win. Mm-hmm. Like they win golds and silvers. They medal.
Yeah.
And just they don't have the resources that some of the rest of the world has. So it's not always all the bells and whistles and taking it to the next level that helps you win, right? Sometimes it's just different.
Athleticism and grit.
They got an X factor.
Right? Exactly.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yep.
I love it. So I actually read a couple of your papers because not that I am an academic by trade, but really wanted to understand your dissertation, your research, the things that you've done. Because I always go back to a memory I have from college. So I worked as a work study student for the baseball program. I went to UC San Diego, and the head coach, I worked directly for him for a bunch of things. So he's a baseball guy, like born and bred. Like when you think of a baseball dude, that's Dan O'Brien, yeah. Right? But his wife was getting her PhD at UCSD at the time. And I just remember the day he came in, giddy as could possibly be. I saw him super giddy twice. One was the day he came in and said they were pregnant, which was very cute. And the second one was when his wife passed her dissertation defense. And I go, well, what's her dissertation on? And it was research, basically about the fruit fly. And if you know much about fruit flies, they live for like 7 days. Mm-hmm. But it was something that happens in this, you know, lifetime of a fruit fly. And it was so cute to see him not have any idea what he was talking about, nor did I. But he had memorized it. And it always sticks with me, this idea that we have so many academics that are spending the amount of time that we are dug into something that is so tiny because the impacts can be so large if they're scaled. And so as I was looking at your research, right, and you talked about it a little bit about the endurance athlete space, but specifically focusing on female athletes, but the cramping, the glucose monitoring, menstrual cycle impact. When I see that without this idea of like, oh, I'm going to talk to this guy who actually did this research, I think to myself like, man, what a very specific thing to be studying. But I imagine as you've gone through much research in that space and done a whole lot of trials, all that kind of stuff, the impacts of what you're learning probably can be super profound, not just for endurance athletes, but for a wide variety of people looking to do whatever they want to do athletically.
Yeah.
But it kind of goes to the same idea of being well-resourced as a nation. Are you seeing that some of the stuff that you've learned over the course of your research, that it's just those little tiny tweaks can make a big difference in that level between being a good athlete and being an elite athlete?
You're going to be angry if I say, no, I learned the exact opposite.
No, that's awesome. Because that's the best part about research and scientific method is we test out hypotheses. And if it's not true, it's not true, you know?
Yeah. So my research was very specific. And I think I had foreshadowed into that with, you know, my practice being primarily female and having an opportunity to go work with Stacy and to really look at the endurance space or ultra endurance, which is what I was in at that time.
Yeah.
And to go back to you, if you want to know about my research, I can answer specific questions about it and what it was. But to go back to you, did I find that like it was the really that real nitty gritty 1% extra that makes us that much better? And the answer is no. When you go through the PhD process, at least in sports performance, you learn a few things. You learn one that most people don't understand the research. Most of the research is applied in ways that had nothing to do with the way that the research actually says to do it. And it's somewhat frustrating because you have a whole industry, like my entire profession, for example, will be doing something with a particular supplement, for example, and it's not anywhere close to what the research or even the methods had suggested. And then there's a gigantic billions of dollars supplement industry that's behind that, that says, here, take this. And, you know, who wants to be the one sports dietitian in such sport, not doing this one particular thing? Nonetheless, right. You're only doing it 1/16th of the way that it's supposed to be done. So the value is probably zero of what you're getting out of it. And it costs a lot of money. There's a whole lot of that. And that is very frustrating. And then coming out the other side of like, well, did you read this? And did you see how this works? And but at the end of the day, they'll be like, well, it doesn't matter because it's not hurting anybody. So the return on investment is maybe we get something, but it doesn't really hurt anybody. And you're like, yeah, but you know, it's not necessarily right. So there's a whole lot of that. So you'll read things. So you'll learn things in school, or you'll learn things in a book, or you'll learn things through said quote unquote literature or best practices and evidence-based things. But there are sayings, they're ubiquitous. They're just all over the place. Then when you go to write your dissertation, you want to say these things, but then you have to find a citation for it. Like you can't say anything without showing where it originally came from, right? Like you really don't have any opinions on your own, at least for part of your dissertation.
Yeah.
For I'd say 90% of your dissertation, you're not the expert. You don't get an opinion.
Yeah. The first three chapters. Yeah.
Yeah. I think mine had like 57,000 words or something. I think only like maybe 500 of them were my actual opinion. Just a bit of an exaggeration, but you have to cite everything. But the things that I was saying or wanted to say, I couldn't say because I couldn't cite them because I couldn't find them because the seminal research that supposedly had came from didn't either exist or it was misread. And when you went and actually found, and this is the frustrating part about a PhD, it can sometimes take months. I'm not talking days or weeks, talking months to track back a piece of verbiage, a sentence to the original research, and then finally read it and go, that's not what this says.
Yeah.
And you're like, how have I gone X decade of time, and how does an entire industry believe such and such thing when that's not even what it said?
Right.
Not that there's anything wrong with research, but it's almost like that game of cans telephone where you say something and you see how far it can change down the road.
Sure.
Yeah. And that's exactly what happens in research, is somebody will read something, but they don't find the original research. So they say something and then it just gets paraphrased and misquoted and reused. And after so many years, it's not even the same. It's so different from the original that the whole story and message becomes completely wrong. Mm-hmm. So those back to like, hey, are we finding like these really small pieces in research? No, not always. Like, that's not what we're finding. We're finding that, like you said, grit, hard work, basics, consistency in nutrition, for example, hydration, and what you eat, whole food, real food type things really do make the big difference. Now, in some sports like endurance sport, where hydration and nutrition come down to, you know, how many grams of something can you tolerate?
Yeah.
You know, are they going to go faster if they had 10 less grams? Who knows? We don't have a crystal ball to go back and test. So we are pushing the limits in some ways, but in a lot of ways, we're not. Sometimes they're just muddying the waters and making it worse.
Fair. I love that you draw that connection with like the game of telephone, because I feel that way about so many things, more so than just research. And I've always felt that there is such a deep need to find out what is the original document, what is the original research, whatever the case might be, what does it say? But the paraphrasing of things is absurd. So my first degree, I immediately go to, my first degree was in religion, and I had high flying hopes to become a pastor when I first went to college. Mm-hmm. And I remember this one time I went to this church, and it was a new church that I hadn't been to. And they were preaching out of this book called The Message. And it is like a paraphrase of a paraphrase of a paraphrase of like three translations of the Bible that is meant for like kids, adolescents. And I just remember them reading, you know, start with a verse out of The Message and, oh, and then we'll talk about the implications and we'll actually have our kind of our sermon. And I remember sitting there going, that's not at all what the Bible actually says in that moment. Yeah. But it had been paraphrased so many times because you're thinking about what does your audience want to hear or what's going to sit with your audience. And there's value to that, right?
Yeah.
There's value to storytelling in a way to make sure that we want to connect in a place that there's some sort of sense of continuity so that I can cross that divide. But my gosh, I just remember, and I was probably 19 years old, sitting there going like, oh, this sermon could totally be received by somebody as like, oh, this is what the Bible says. And meanwhile, it is not at all what the Bible says. And I go to religion just because that's my space of where I can make the closest parallel. But I think it's so true. And to your point about the supplement community, I've constantly thought to myself, like, this is an unregulated community that is a multi-billion dollar industry. And where is actually the science behind it? And to your point, it sounds like it is a interpretation of a paraphrase of a this, of a that, that's just going to be sexy to sell. And that is slightly terrifying.
It is slightly terrifying. I, you know, I won't tell you exactly what the supplement is or who's using it and where they use it, because it's like I said, it's pretty ubiquitous. But like when you go back and look at the research, said supplement was used three times a day and it had small value. If anything, it was very controversial whether it had value. But then you've got, you know, ex sports team, not even the ones that I work for, any of them, you know, dietitians or their nutritionists are like, well, you want to take this, or the athletes, or I take this. But if you take it once, it does nothing. It's absolutely a waste of money.
Right.
And so if it's chicken soup or mental chicken soup and it works, I guess it would be great. But I can think of, you know, a handful, because I have a whole spreadsheet of my supplements that I do literature reviews on to figure out, you know, how are these supposed to use, what's best practices. And when you look at what they're supposed to be and how they're supposed to be used, they're just, no one's using it that
way. Yeah.
Very few.
It's fascinating. That's crazy. My mind is just going in so many places. I especially think about it now here in 2025 with how powerful, and I think we've seen this through the recent election cycles, we've seen this in public opinion, you name it, that there's a few voices that are just loud, right? And I think the podcasting space has been a space where we've heard some really loud voices, and that's where people go to get their information. And it makes me think of even like the cold plunging stuff, right? I mean, that was propagated by a few podcasters that, oh, cold plunging's going to do this, 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 and this.
Yeah.
So naturally, I'm a naturally curious person. So I'm like, well, let me go in and find some of that research. And to your exact point, maybe chicken soup for your soul, maybe chicken soup for your brain, maybe not, right?
Yeah.
But it is so fascinating that something gets pushed in one place. And I think the fear, the biggest fear for me is the willingness of the general public to just be like, this person said, so it's good. And there's no validation. There's no checking sources. There's no seeing like, oh, well, is that really what that means? Or we're just taking what people are saying as gold. And that's more scary to me, is that we have a large portion of the population that is just willing to accept what somebody says. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's, maybe I'm just a naturally defiant person, but usually someone tells me something and they assert it as fact, whether it is or not, my immediate gut reaction is like, you're wrong.
Yeah.
Right. Or maybe I could accept that, but I'd want to make sure there's some credibility behind it. And yeah. So that part is, I don't know, it's crazy. And then to see it monetized, I think the way that it has been specifically in supplements and in that space to me is just like the ultimate capitalistic greed, right?
I wouldn't call it capitalistic greed. Look, capitalism's out there and consumers vote with their paycheck, right? I think you just got to give them what they want.
But fair.
Hey, don't get me started with Huberman and Adia and I'll leave Joe Rogan alone because he is a funny guy. He does some great conspiracy theory stuff that I like. Who's the other guy, DeLauer? But they are notorious for being incredibly wrong. And matter of fact, I think one of them actually has an entire podcast series now about how I was wrong and changed their minds. Like, yeah, you have to because you've been so wrong about so many things. And the other one of those that I listed, his number of things that he does every day, if you were to go back through podcast episode number one to where he is now, the guy would have no free minutes in his life to breathe. He's on so many different programs and things in the morning. He's just like, whatever, man. There's not enough time in your life to do the things that you say you do and take the things you take. And it's interesting because their backgrounds aren't anything in what they're talking about, right? I mean,
right.
And that's the worst part is people think, oh, he's a doctor, such and such. Look, man, I'm Dr. Andrew Dole, and that doesn't mean anything for my expertise level in some of these other areas. Like there are still scopes and there are still scopes to practice. You can be smart and you can understand how to read research, but it doesn't mean you understand the nuances of everything and you can't necessarily put it together, especially in the nutrition scope, right? I'm kind of protective of that space because unless you've worked in some areas and you know the nuances between clinical and you just can't say these things, but they do, and they will, and they make a great amount of money of it. And like you said, yes, people follow them because they're doctor. And I think there's some misappropriation or misuse of that title, which I think is, man, it's just dishonest, to be really fair.
Yeah.
And so I think we see that a lot. I question whether or not I should ever put doctor in front of anything. Like it was fun when I first got it. So I went and changed it on Instagram and social media, but yeah. I did look up the etiquette. Like where do you use it and when's the appropriate time? And then when are you using it for your personal gain when you shouldn't? Because when people say doctor, no one looks them up to say, are you an MD or are you a chiropractor? Mm-hmm. Right? Very different. Or are you a research PhD? Well, that's very different than all three of those in a different way, right?
Right.
So now, if you're a doctor of such and such in your area and that was your research and you are an expert, then fabulous, then you know quite a bit. But yeah, people will just...
I get it.
They just jump all in on people who say things.
So I have a law degree, which technically, right, is a Juris Doctorate. But one of our mandatory ethics classes, we literally learn, like, you can never refer to yourself as doctor because that'll be misleading. That'll be this. I went to law school in Minnesota. And so, like, there's a very famous Minnesota state case that basically had to prosecute an attorney for fraud because she pushed herself out there as doctor and tried to hide behind this idea that like, oh no, it's a Juris Doctorate. So that means I'm a doctor. Mm-hmm. And I once got in this argument with a professional here at MSU Denver that did that. And I was like, you can't do that. We have the same degree. You can't call yourself a doctor. Mm-hmm. It was pretty funny. But then I think about, no, what is that credibility for the average person that doesn't understand that I didn't have to do a dissertation. I don't actually have research. I studied a completely different thing, but I'm pushing myself out there as a doctor. That's pretty problematic. So,
well, and there's different types of PhDs.
Right.
Right. Like, so like there are people who've got a PhD who have never done their own research ever. Like it really depends on what are you researching. Not all PhDs mean that you've created an experimental protocol, you've collected data and you've run it. Some people are just researching through books or no lab stuff ever. Like, yeah, it's not the same. It doesn't mean the same everywhere.
Yeah. If you're anything like me, you know how important it is to never stop learning. Whether your goal is to transition into a new career or upskill your own, MSU Denver's Career Launchpad helps alumni stay competitive in the workforce with self-paced online courses able to be completed in as little as 4 weeks. Taught by MSU Denver instructors, you can fit lifelong learning into your schedule at msudenver.com/careerlaunchpad and use code MSUALUM50, that's MSUALUM50, for 50% off your next course. Calling all roadrunners, MSU Denver is turning 60. That's right, since 1965, MSU Denver has provided high-quality, accessible education to over 115,000 roadrunners. And during the 2025-2026 academic year, we want to celebrate our 60 years of excellence with you. Join your fellow roadrunners at Homecoming 2025 this October. And whether you attend the 5th Annual Women of MSU Denver Alumni Networking event, celebrate with us at the annual tailgate party, or even run in the 5K, we want to celebrate our 60th anniversary with you. So visit msudenver.edu/homecoming for event details and to RSVP. This episode is brought to you by The Crane, always working at construction sites. Let's talk about what you're doing now, because this is pretty fascinating. So you are now with the Arizona Cardinals, so you're back, you're working with the NFL. So my most important first question is, who's tougher, NFL guys or rugby? I think I know the answer.
There are different athletes that do different things. They are incredible human beings all around from most sports. I can't answer that question because it's just different. An NFL player wouldn't do particularly well in rugby right away, and rugby wouldn't do well in the NFL.
Fair.
Some of the skill positions, like a lot of people don't think the NFL is like a lot of heavy thinkers and smart. They are very tuned in, very skilled. And even the positions that you don't think are skill, there's a lot of skill and a lot of cognitive capacity going on there that you're like, wow, like you never would have known. I never would have known, and you know, until I entered the sport. So they're just very different.
Very. I would agree. It is a fascinating thing. That's why I think it's like a dime a dozen. Like I had a Bo Knows poster when I was a kid in my closet. So Bo Jackson, and it was half of him with the Royals, half of him with the Raiders. And there's so few of those people that I think have that purest form of athleticism where you can translate your skill set at the highest level to football, baseball, right? I know it's a trap of a question to have asked you who's tougher, because I get that these are totally different skill sets. But when you come across those guys or women that can just be elite at multiple spaces, different types of sports that require different types of movement. You know, I think LeBron James is one of those guys that could probably go be not anymore, but probably could have been a tight end in the NFL. Mm-hmm. There's a few of these athletes that can really do both of those, but you're absolutely right that when you're talking about something at that highest level, NFL, the amount of skill, intelligence, and putting it all together it's hard to do. And it's incredible that now you're surrounded by a whole squad of them, let alone a whole league, and probably learning a lot of new things along the way, I would imagine.
Everyone looks at the physicality piece, like, oh, genetically, they're amazing, or they're talented in what they do. There's a lot of really talented individuals, and I've had the pleasure of being around a lot of the really talented endurance athletes, again, world champions, gold medal and world champion rugby players.
Yeah.
And now in the NFL, there's an intelligence piece. There's like a cognitive brain smarts. You can be really talented, but you can't be smart enough to actually be good or be great. And these athletes they're all of that. And the systems aren't easy in the NFL. Like mm-hmm. And the systems are a little bit easier, let's say, in rugby, but you still have to understand and read the game and see it. And you have to have this ability to process lots of things that are happening. And in sevens particularly, sevens is a very beautiful game. There's seven people on the field and the pitch, and it's a huge pitch. And you've got big athletes moving really fast and lots of room to gain tons of speed. And the contact at which that happens it's brutal and it's very violent, but there's also, it's a game of mistakes and opportunities. That's really what it is in sevens rugby. It's who wins is the one who made the least amount of mistakes and those who capitalize on the opponent's mistakes. You have to read that. You have to see. You have to not make mistakes. Mm-hmm. So their ability to cognitively reset and just read these patterns and think quickly and still be physical under that type of physical duress, it's impressive. And then you just move it to the NFL. It's the same. You've got individuals who are under incredible physical duress. These are men who are powerful individuals,
right?
And they have to think quick Yeah, it's a game, the cat and mouse, and it's chess, and they play it. No one ever gives them credit for that, and they should.
I agree. So talk me through kind of what your role is. I know you're new to it, but we're a couple months away from season, or a couple weeks away probably from season starting for you. What is that going to look like for the next 6 months for you?
Yeah, so my role is a performance dietitian. So I lead my assistant, myself, and help shape the culinary department, our executive chef, into the types of foods and meals that we generally have that are performance-based, like essentially performance nutrition. Our role as a dietitian can be very large or very small, and it really depends on what your scope or capacity is to do that. So generally speaking, if we were to draw like a Venn diagram for a performance dietitian, there's sports practitioner, clinician, right? Your one-on-ones, your return to play, injury. What are we giving supplement-wise? How are we feeding when somebody gets hurt, for a variety of different things that happen in sports? You've got operations. There's always the admin piece. A lot of times your food service, you're ordering your supplements. What do you have? Maintaining inventories. And then you've got your sports scientist piece. It's like looking out, scanning the environment all the time. What's best practices? What are we doing from a clinical standpoint? What is sports doing around other disciplines? What supplements? What types of protocols are best for us? Evidence-based practice for really hydration-wise, food, eating, protein content, those types of things, macros, to feed and fuel these athletes overall.
Right.
And then depending on where your expertise is, so coming from food service, right? Mm-hmm. So the kitchens and how to take that and translate those foods into things where you have players eating, you know, on site is really important, because 100% of zero is zero. So if your food isn't good and you can't get them to eat, then you don't really have a lot of influence on their nutrition, right? So that aspect of being able to work with our executive chef and allow them and the kitchen staff, the F&B, to do what they do really well, but then have the experience to shape that into what does this look like from a performance perspective, to know like this is what we can and can't do, and this is what our expectations are. So that's really my role, is to work, like, we straddle really performance and high performance sport. There's medical and there's performance.
Right.
And the dietitian, if they're good at what they do, sits right in between those. They're like the glue between medical and performance, the MDT.
Yeah.
Because we sit on the performance side and we also sit on the medical side, depending on what your role is and what your expertise and where you can contribute through the multidisciplinaries. So we kind of blend that all together. And that's kind of my role, is to sit in between to make sure that they, well, my role is to do my job, which is clinical dietetics, medical nutrition therapy, sports recovery, return to play, fuel the athletes so they have what they need to do. But then from the food service perspective, like, do we have a program here that's feeding the athletes what they need to succeed? And are we putting forth good culture and good habits?
I love it.
And showing them what they should be doing.
Right. And I look at the role that you're in, and in that straddling between the medical and the performance side, that you're just kind of a dot connector. You're seeing what needs to happen in those places, and you're coming up with solutions, or, you know, whatever the case might be. And so I'm naturally inclined to a type of role like that, because I love when curiosity can kind of meet with this idea of, hey, there could be a synergy. I hate that word, but that's exactly what it is, like the synergy between these two areas, which is pretty incredible.
There's a lot of synergy in our space. Like, sports dietitians have tons of synergy.
Yeah.
Like, food is everywhere. It's also another thing why people think they have an opinion too, is because they eat and they know, like, everybody eats. So they think they're a nutritionist, so they know something, which is like, well, okay, maybe you don't, but I get it.
Yeah.
Right.
And again, you're kind of new into this space, but maybe you can even think through your experience with rugby. Do you find that the younger athletes coming in are a little bit more conducive to taking instruction and kind of following into a program and a protocol versus older athletes? Or do you see the exact opposite, where the younger ones are like, no, my body's great. I eat, I'm good. I'm still burning a ton of calories because I'm only 23 and can still do what I want, versus some of the maybe older athletes that are like, no, I have to really maintain what I'm doing and I have to be very thoughtful? Or have you seen a difference at all between kind of the age or the rookie and veteran status?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I got to answer that in multiple pieces, because the younger athletes, like you said, sports dietetics is relatively new. You know, Dave Ellis at Nebraska, and he's the grandfather of sports dietetics, really, he kind of brought it all together. Sports dietitians really weren't around, and there were only a few dietitians who had got into that with some universities, and then they called their way into high performance sport, professional sport. But what dietitians were doing back then and what we do now, not necessarily the same thing at all, right? It's kind of been carved out.
Right.
But that said, you know, there's very few Division I teams. I don't think there's any who don't have a performance dietitian to some way. And most of the programs, football is kind of one of their marquee programs. So these players are coming out having worked with a dietitian to begin with. So to answer your question, these younger players having exposure to a sports dietitian in some way are like, hey, yep, I need to be eating. I need to have hydration. They understand what we do. Whereas, you know, dietitians in the past, if you were to think about it, it's like, oh, you guys are, you know, food Nazis, you sit in the kitchen and you make meal plans, or you work in a hospital. Like, what's a dietitian? No one really knew or had any idea. But within the sports realm, a sports dietitian, like, yep, these college guys and college girls, they've seen them, they're being worked with. So they're more open, and a lot of the things they know, like, they've got some really good basic foundations. Like, yep, I know I need to drink, I know I need these things. And it's kind of like, I don't want to say they're like children, but it's kind of like children. It really is, because you introduce a child to something and you have to do it continually over and over and over again. And at some point in time, they'll like, oh, yep, I'm going to act on that. But it's only because they've been exposed to it. And it's the same as with these athletes coming up through high school and college, being exposed to that concept of performance nutrition is really something that will be a pillar to your game. And then they get to where they are and they're like, yep, I get it. Now, you go back to your older players, the ones that have been around in the league for a while who didn't have exposure to dietetics, sports dietitians. The sports dietitians didn't really have influence on them. That goes two ways.
Yeah.
It goes one of two ways, because those players are like, I just do what I've always done and it doesn't matter what I eat. I'm this good. And there are people who are like that. Right.
Right.
And then you have others who have turned that age bracket, you know, right around 25, you start to see a decline in testosterone. And testosterone is like super juice, right? It allows you to eat like garbage, maintain your lean body mass, stay lean, you lose fat, you repair, you recover, you can burn the candle from both ends, and you somehow just are ready to go all the time. As you get older, that starts to drop off and your resilience changes. And those players and athletes tend to start looking for, what can I do to maintain my career? And that's nutrition, the thing that they had been really avoiding for a great deal of time. Then you get the generational athletes who are just unreal. And we have a few of them who are like, they're dialed into nutrition. They eat very consistently. They know what they're doing. They have a plan, and they adhere to that plan every day, very structured. Mm-hmm. And they look at, and their bodies respond. So they're really all over the place with how that looks. The most frustrating part, however, will be the young players who didn't get exposure to a sports dietitian, and they look up to players, for example, who have been in the league, and they know for a fact, it could be rugby players, NFL, like, well, I know they didn't do this. They eat Kentucky Fried Chicken every day and they're getting paid millions.
Yeah.
Why do I need to pay attention to nutrition? You're like, yep, well, you know, it's hard to argue against that sometimes, like, yes, but you also don't know exactly what they're doing. So some of those players who post on Instagram, right? Like, oh, they're at KFC. That was the one time that month that they had done it. But you see an Instagram feed of this over and over again. You're like, well, this guy is, you know, eating fast food all the time. You're like, no, really, they're not. They're eating, you know, training table food and very consistent, or have a chef. You just see this one piece. So
Yeah. There's
a lot of moving pieces to that question.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate the thorough answer. And I think about that. I have two nephews that are college football players. They were at Iowa the last couple of years, but just transferred to Central Michigan. And from the moment they're there, it is just like, I need to make sure that I have this and that and this type of protein, and I'm on this and da da da. I mean, I was there when Joey was born. I mean, it's been 18 years, right? And he is the most stubborn, picky eating kid. He was the guy, we'd be at a Mexican restaurant and we have to ask for hot dogs or a hamburger.
Yeah.
Because like, the kid just only wanted to eat. But then all of a sudden he gets to college and it's like, oh, this is actually going to help my body. And this is great. And he turns that switch on. And so I do think that exposure is going to make your job, I think, a lot easier moving forward, right? Just so that there's this baseline that you're not constantly having to justify what you're trying to do and convince people that it's for their good. Mm-hmm. Not to mention, yeah, the Instagram posts about fast food that gives people the wrong impression, right?
Yeah.
I do want to circle back to kind of your time at MSU Denver. So I know you said you started school back in the 90s. You ended up here for the hospitality degree in 2006. You finished that, then the nutrition and dietetics degree. Were there any faculty members, classes, or even the way that we structured our learning experience for you that made it conducive to kind of where you were in your career? Because you were working while you were doing this, I'm presuming. Mm-hmm. So what about other than, you know, being downtown and appealing in that space? What about the way that we structure things, or if there were faculty members that encouraged you in a way, something that was kind of key for you?
Yes, I think there was probably one faculty member from each one of those programs that had said something that had stuck forever and just sort of shaped my perception of how to move forward. Mm-hmm. That said, the teaching then, the instructors, the professors who were there had been in the industry. And I think for me, having gone back as a bit of an older student, right, not having come out, I had already had careers.
Right.
I had already worked professionally in certain places. To then go to school and have instructors or professors there who were teaching you, they had worked, they had been in the industry, and it wasn't like decades ago, it was somewhat recent. For me, that was always important because you were not just getting book information. They were telling you like, hey, this is what happens. This is what the industry looks like. This is what to expect. In those moments, you actually get out in the industry and you're like, I remember this and this meant something. It was really useful because I've gone through other programs. And won't say where, but obviously yeah. I haven't gone to school long enough to be like, this person hasn't been in the industry in a very, very long time. It's not how any of this works. And it was just teaching from a book. Now, that's unfortunate to some extent. So I think what I'm trying to get at is Metro at that time had skilled individuals who were teaching content that was relatable, but most importantly, coming from industry specific and applied. Mm-hmm. And that was really important because to hit the ground running, that's something that I didn't have time to, because look, I'm on, this is career number 3 for me, right? I started in tech, was an IBM Lexmark guy. I was a total tech nerd, right? And nothing then to get into culinary, to become a CEC, that's career number 2. Then to become a sports dietitian, that's career number 3. You don't have a lot of time to go through that 5 to 6 years of learning. You really got to hit the ground and get that learning curve going. And I felt like that's something that I got out of Metro for both of the programs that I had. That's probably the biggest thing, was they taught me the things I needed.
Yeah, I've heard that a lot. And I think it is one of those things that we hang our hat on as an institution, is that you're getting an excellent education. And that excellence is a combination of this, yep, we're going to teach you theory, we're going to teach you book knowledge, we're going to make sure you understand best practices and you understand how the industry ebbs and flows. But because of the experiences and the hands-on experiences of our faculty members, they're also going to have that moment where they lead in and say, but let me tell you how it actually works, mm-hmm. right? And there's so much value to that, because for traditional age students, you know, you're 18 years old when you start this. You're done by 22, presuming that you get through in 4 years, right?
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you're 22 with very little work experience going, well, this is what my teacher told me. This is what I read in the book. And that doesn't always translate well to positive employment. And so I think it's the combination of faculty members that have worked in the industry, they understand what that looks like, and also students like you that were coming in after having one career or at least significant work experience to be able to come in and share your expertise in that space. That was my experience here at MSU Denver. Like, I was a traditional student right out of high school, went on, got a master's degree, got a law degree, and then I've been at MSU for about 12 years. I don't know, it was probably like 2018 or 19. I just started taking classes because I could. I've told the story many times on the podcast, but like, I was afraid of being like the 40-year-old lady in the back of a classroom. And like, I just kind of wanted to sink into a chair, just do what I needed to do. And what I found is that my peer students were so excited to have somebody in this space. It's like, oh my God, you've been working for 20 years. I mean, I remember one young woman coming up to me because she was graduating at the same time as me. And she had a couple interviews and she had been offered a job. And she was like, how do I negotiate a salary? And I was like, what a value, like, just to have a resource of people that can tell you, like, here's some things I can tell you, like, here's things to bring to the table. Here's some realities of like, this is entry level work and you're an entry level person. You might not have as much negotiation space as you want, but here's also what you can stand on. And so I think it's that combination of having the faculty members, but also the students that are working, that are maybe coming back for a second career to say, let me tell you how this works and let me try and guide you a little.
Yeah, the guidance is important. Going to school and having smart people was one thing, but Mm-hmm. Again, you step out of the school with a degree, you know nothing. that's the one thing everybody knows is like, I've stepped out of school with 4 degrees now. And every time it's like, well, you know, I just knew less than I did before because there's so much out there. And you really have to get the work experience, and having people who can tie that into the classroom piece is really important. And Metro was able to do that for me both times, actually.
Well, I love it. And I'm glad that experience was true for you as well. Are you still an endurance athlete, or what? And what was your specialty? Were you triathlons? Were you, what were you?
Yeah, no.
Or are you?
No.
I don't want to say past tense.
Yeah, no. Unfortunately, my running career has been put short somehow. The aging body doesn't want to keep up.
Well, you know, I've heard there's a couple supplements that might help you with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry.
I wish that was the case. I'd be on them. Trust me. So the gal who came and asked me to help out with her Ironman, right? And I started doing nutrition and was like, well, why don't you do one? I'm like, I don't want to have anything to do with triathlon. Well, that was an 8-year thing. Like, I did triathlons for 8 years. It was a great time. It was a adult onset triathlete is what you could say, right? I didn't get started till 30s. Then I got into ultra running and I fell in love. Like, I never looked back to triathlon ever again. And I ran for, it was a couple of years. I just loved ultra running. And that's, I'm a little sad that I can't do it anymore. Something about just getting lost or running up Pikes Peak or the Rocky Mountain Trail. Like, you just see things that you'll never, people won't even imagine as you run those kind of distances and that far. So
yeah,
that's what I was into. That's what I did. No, I don't do that anymore. Right now, I don't really have the time to do a whole lot. So I'm just sort of in the gym trying not to be old.
Fair.
And stay fit.
Fair. That's the research that needs to happen, because it is this losing battle that it turns out about middle age, your body just doesn't want you to do the things you did before. And it's a tough go of it, I'll tell you. And I've been fortunate enough, like, I never had any significant injuries, you know, through college, all that kind of stuff. But now here I am, you know, 43, and things just hurt.
Right.
And that is a real bummer when that has been so much of somebody's life for so long, was just being able to go out and do what you want. And now it's like, maybe I shouldn't ride that bike because my knee really has been pretty bad lately. And then I'll be inflamed for a bit. And I have, you know, like, it's just, it sucks.
Yeah.
Getting old sucks. There's positives to it. I feel wiser. I feel more patient.
Absolutely.
I feel more able to, like, embrace people, and like the touchy-feely parts of me are better, right? Like, because I just have so much more empathy and I have so much more capacity to feel things. But the physical stuff sucks.
Yeah. Well, you're going to hurt either way. You're going to hurt whether you do it. Well, I don't want to take credit for this, but somebody once said to me, you're going to hurt either way. You're going to hurt whether you do it, and you're going to hurt whether you don't. So you might as well look good or have fun. So, like, I continue to push myself to do things, even though I don't feel amazing, because I know if I don't, I'm just going to feel the same way anyway. So I might as well have some benefit. And finding things that I'm a bit risk adverse right now. So, like, there are things that I'm not doing. Like, I'm not falling off a bike. I'm not doing these things anymore. It's just not worth the effort or the risk of injury.
Right.
There are some things you can find that you can have fun with. And I think that's what I'm been open to now, is like, what's new? What can I do that's fun? That's, you know, rock climbing, started bouldering, rowing, you know, things that, just looking for different stuff.
I'll tell you, I've heard a lot of people, especially people from my past that knew me to be much more active and much more athletic and all those things, are like, oh, come on, you know, you miss it, you this and that. None of that has been powerful to persuade me to do things again. But I'll tell you, this idea that, well, it's going to hurt anyhow, so you might as well have some fun while it's going to hurt, might actually be the thing that encourages me to be like, yeah, what's the difference? My knees are going to hurt no matter what, so you might as well do the things that you like doing.
Yeah.
You know? So this might be my turning point, Andrew, and it might be you.
That's it. You're going to feel terrible.
That's right.
That's it. You just got to find it.
Yeah.
You just got to find it. Yeah. You can sit on the couch and you're stand up and feel terrible, or you can go move around and maybe feel terrible, but at least you're better health. It's a quality of life thing, right? That's the big thing.
I get it. So we finish up every podcast with what we call our rapid fire questions. They're the same 3 questions we ask each guest. You can have some time to think about it, but the idea is that it's kind of the first thing that comes to mind.
Sure.
All right. Okay. First rapid fire question. What is your favorite MSU Denver memory?
Walking down from, okay, so seeing my mom on campus. She was going to school at the same time because that's the kind of campus it was. Like that's the memory. Because you know, there's that huge throughway that used to go that goes right down the middle of all the campuses, right?
Yeah.
And so you just walk that, and you can't help but see people. And I was down there going to school, and I'm walking down there, and there's my mom. And she was going to school. She was getting her first bachelor's degree when I was, I think, getting either my first or my second. I can't remember. It was just one of those memories that I never forgot.
I love that so much. I didn't know that your mom went to school here and that you guys were on campus at the same time. Mm-hmm. It's such a touching story to me. And we've had multiple people that have said that. And we see a real kind of Roadrunner legacy often where it's like, oh, yeah, well, my dad went here or my uncles or my cousins. So we know that this is a place that people naturally gravitate to. We actually had a staff member that was on my team, oh, maybe 4 or 5 years ago. Her job function, she was one of our event managers, was to put on commencement. And I remember it was about maybe a month before, and she was like, Jamie, so this afternoon commencement on the commencement day, like, I'm going to kind of be offline. And I was like, Kylie, like, you run commencement. You're going to need to have your headphones on and do stuff. And she's like, well, my mom's graduating. And I was like, oh my gosh. So she actually got to go on stage and hand the diploma to her mom because we're like, oh no, we're going to make this special for your family. But it was such a cool deal. And how proud she was as a daughter to see her mom do that, I thought was so very cool. And so I'm just imagining you just, you know, walking down campus, taking a look at things, and then all of a sudden, oh, there's my mom.
There was my mom.
That had to have been very, very cool.
Yeah.
All right. So second question, what does it mean to you to be a roadrunner?
You know, I've read that question and I've thought about it. And the answer I want to give you is that the Roadrunner, it's unassuming. Metro is unassuming. It's in the middle of the city. It's not like this super prestigious university, but there's amazing people coming out of there doing anything they want to. And it's because the university was accessible, because it had the programs that people needed. It was accessible that they could go to. It was affordable, accessible from a traffic standpoint. Like you could live anywhere in that whole metro area all around surrounding and go to school. Like you didn't have to go to CU Boulder. You didn't have to go to Regis or Fort Collins. Like Metro puts out amazing people who are doing quality things. And I think that's the cool piece. I think with Metro, it's like, you know what? It's a great school, but it's unassuming. Not everybody knows a lot about it. And the people coming out of it are very high quality, doing very high quality things. I think that's what it means, is you didn't have to start out from the top to be amazing. It's about what you put into it and what you get out of it. With opportunity, Metro provided opportunity more than once.
Oh, I love that.
Twice for me.
Yeah, and for your mom and your cousin.
Indeed. It's a family thing.
I love that idea that education always should be. It should be this. Like I've worked my whole career, 25 plus years in higher education, and it's because I genuinely believe that education, it's the tool. It's the thing that can allow people to be mobile, whether it's socially, whether it's economically, whatever the case is, it is a equalizer. It gives you that space to get where you need to go. And so I love your comment about this idea that you don't have to start at the top to get to the top. That hard work and all the things that you can learn along the way and the things that you can embrace can get you there. And this is a school, I think, that provides a unique environment and opportunity for people to realize that potential. The many of people that I've interviewed on this podcast before, they'll always say, there's at least five I can think of right offhand that'll be like, oh no, I came to Metro. I thought I was dumb. I thought I couldn't do things. I thought I was bad at school. And I actually learned that I wasn't here because I had people invest in me a little bit differently and my mindset was changed. And I love that you can have kind of those epiphanies and that growth opportunity here on campus.
That you can. Like, I didn't get it. I didn't even accept it to colleges out of high school. Like, I had under academic probation, my grade point average was terrible out of high school. I just didn't even care the last 2 years. My SATs, ACTs were miserable. And to think that I've got 4 degrees, got to the top of 2 professions and have a PhD, it's because I was given an opportunity later. I didn't, you know, we just don't understand what we need to be doing early, some of us anyway. And Metro was there for us when we needed it. Yeah.
Ah, I love that. All right. The last one. If you could put a billboard on campus with a piece of advice for all students to see, what would it say?
And I can't take credit for this one, but it's do something every day. That came from my dietetics internship. And it's what they told us. I went to a dietetics internship that was a distance. It was a remote one, meaning I had to manage my own time, my own space. I had to find certain things. It wasn't where I showed up everywhere. You had to really be very committed to what you're doing to get through this at a reasonable amount of time, because no one was going to drag you through it. And it was said, just do something every day towards your goal. Didn't have to complete something, don't have to finish anything, but you need to do something every day. From that time that I heard that, from the time that I've been at Tyson all these years through my master's degree, that's actually to get through my master's degree, because it took me 4 years through a master's because I was working full time. It was just, I'm doing something today. I'm moving forward. In 4 years, I'll be somewhere. My PhD, even though I was a full-time student and I was working for the Olympic campaigns, was just do something every day. And that has gotten me through 15 years of just continuing to move forward. Just do something every day. Something is what I would say.
I love it. I super appreciate this idea that it's not necessarily about finishing or completing. You just got to keep moving. I think there's a lot of power in that. And I think especially for our students, that can be very powerful, because there's a lot of barriers that can come up. 87% of our students are working while they're in school. So there's times where school isn't the number one priority. We have a lot of working parents. We have people that are taking care of extended family, their immediate family, whatever the case is. There's times where your priorities have to shift a bit and school maybe isn't that number one. But if you can just do something and continue to move forward, then you can get through this. So I think that's very solid advice. And even though you didn't come up with it, I'm going to credit you with it in my brain for when I don't want to do stuff. I'm going to be like, you know what? Andrew said, do something. And he said, it's going to hurt if you do it or you don't. So just do it.
That's right. Exactly. Well, I mean, there were times when like I could only take a class or two because I was paying out of pocket.
Yeah.
Like I had already had enough student loans. Like I was self-paid through two of my degrees. You couldn't afford it, but you just didn't have time, but I needed to be doing something. I didn't want to look back a year, two, three, 4 years saying, hey, I waited. I just needed to be doing something during that time. And then it's even on a smaller scale, like in a class, like I need to do something on the bus, in the car, 5 minutes here. Sometimes that's what it is, 3 to 5 minutes every day of something or a big project. I was always doing something every day and I live by it now. And it's advice that would give, if I could put it on a billboard, that's what it would be to get people to be successful, is just do something every day.
Well, I love it. And I appreciate so much you taking the time to chat with us. If nothing else, I am newly motivated for a whole lot of things. I love your energy and I appreciate that. I know you're right before the start of season. And so we had to make some really specific time. You took time out of visiting with your family to do this, but I can't thank you enough, because I think this is going to be an extremely impactful episode where we get to see, to your point, not just the incredible things that are coming out of our alumni, but some really thoughtful things about how we can all choose to just be a little bit better every day. So thank you, Andrew.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Glad we were able to connect.
Awesome. All right. Well, we'll see you soon, Andrew. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Bird Talk, special accommodation provided by University Advancement. Thank you to Brandy Rideout, production provided by David Sharman, and I'm your host, Jamie Hurst. Keep running, roadies.